History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they do not have to go untold. All that's required, really, the simple steps of asking a few questions and taking the time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that journey, we're always educated, we're always entertained, and really without fail, we find ourselves inspired by these stories we get to hear from our greatest generation. Last time, we met a 105-year-old D-Day survivor named Martin Copenhafer, but we didn't have time to finish that conversation. His memories are so crystal clear. If you missed last week's episode, you can access it anytime on hometownheroesradio.com. And if you've seen the new movie Pressure, starring Brendan Fraser as General Dwight Eisenhower, you may recognize the name Exercise Tiger or Operation Tiger, a practice invasion in April 1944 that turned into an absolute tragedy, but was kept under wraps for decades. Pressure is an excellent film. I highly recommend it. And if you go see it now, you can compare that depiction of the devastation at Slapton Sands to Mr. Copenhafer's description of it, a topic that came up when I asked him if anything had ever made him truly fearful throughout his years as a quartermaster on LSTs in World War II.
The only time I was ever really scared was during Operation Tiger. Operation Tiger was conducted about 2 weeks before the invasion. It was a practice landing. They loaded up 8 LSTs, and they were going to land at the Slapton Sands and simulate the way you're going to do it, the way they thought you were going to do it. You're going to dash up on the beach and unload. Well, the Germans finally got wind of it from the radio traffic and sent over 15 E-boats, and they torpedoed 3 of the LSTs of the 8. Well, the LSTs were in 2 groups. Groups of 4 came out of different ports. We came out of Portland, Weymouth, and the other 4 LSTs came out of Dartmouth, I think, and they're the ones that got attacked. 2 of them sunk immediately, and 1 of them torpedoed, rolled over. Lost over 700 people. They had a full combat load aboard. It was the biggest, dumbest thing done by a whole lot of thing was operated by the British. And the British gummed up everything all the time. And this here, in particular, they had different radio frequencies for the Americans and the British, so they couldn't talk to each other. They got screwed up on the time of the landings. The British were shoving the beach when they were trying to land on it. And that kind of stuff. It was killing people on the beach, American soldiers on the beach. And Eisenhower put a lid on everything. When we got back to port, we turned around. They canceled the thing. We turned around and thought we might have seen the E-boats on their way back to Germany. We're not sure. We didn't have any proper escort. One little British corvette with one little 3-inch gun was supposed to protect this convoy. Well, they obviously couldn't do it. They were out there shooting up star shells to see if they could light things up and see some. The enemy, it wouldn't have done them any good anyway. The E-boats could go 60 miles an hour, and the little boat they had out there could go about 20. Totally inadequate. But the British were always afraid of risking their ships. You know, they didn't want to get them out to get them torpedoed. So the whole thing was a fiasco. So Eisenhower put out the word, put a lid on it, nobody talks about it. No, you don't talk about that operation. And they never did. He even didn't put it in his report. Yeah. About Operation Tiger. They had a movie program on it last year. Somebody put together a movie program on Operation Tiger, tell what it was and what had happened at that time. And since then, there has been some discussion about it. The admiral that was in charge, British admiral, committed suicide. That's what happened to him. Yeah. Was it because he bungled the whole thing so badly? They should have had a proper Navy presence out there to screen the ships from the E-boats, the torpedo boats. That's what a destroyer's for. It's to destroy E-boats, torpedo boats. Well, anyway, that was the only time I was scared. It was pitch black in the middle of the night. Couldn't see anything. And all we got word on the radio, we had the radio on, we knew they were being attacked by torpedo boats. And we were waiting, wondering when our turn was going to come. Well, fortunately, it didn't come. Our four LSTs were not attacked. And so we got back in port safely. We were anchored in the Portland, Weymouth Harbor. And every night we had an air raid. Every night, I think. Germans would send over some bombers from high altitude and try to hit something with a bomb, drop bombs in the harbor. They'd never hit anything. They drop them in the water, and people then they have to go out and find these bombs and disable them. They weren't sure they're bombs or mines. They didn't really sure what they were. When we left there for the D-Day morning, which was interesting, was the LSTs were in two long rows as they pulled out of the harbor. Down in the row came a small boat, speedboat, and standing up in the bow was Winston Churchill, holding up a V for victory sign, and the King of England was sitting in the stern as they went by. Winston was down there wishing us all well on our way over that morning. That was a rough ride, and all the GIs got sicker than sick. They weren't used to the, like the sailors were. You know, we didn't bother us after a while, but it sure did bother them. There was the sickest bunch of soldiers you ever saw going across there. We passed one floating body. I remember some guy in a blue uniform was laying on the water floating. Probably was on a minesweeper. Probably the blue got blowed up, very likely, you know, or fell overboard or something. Hard to say. We towed a pontoon. That was another great idea of somebody's. They'd hook together pontoons about three wide and about five long, big pontoons, and put a couple of outboard engines on the back and use them to unload the ships. It worked great. Just worked great. And that was some great idea. When we got over there, we never beached. We unloaded on the pontoons and smaller landing craft. After we got unloaded, we became a hospital, a field hospital. We had all the equipment we needed for a field hospital. All the bunks we're building, welded on the sides of the tank deck, operating platform, four doctors and 20 nurses. And they were taking all these people in, casualties that were being brought aboard, mostly 82nd Airborne and 101st Airborne, few German soldiers that came aboard as casualties, and they were doing what they could for them. We had an incinerator sitting on the stern of the ship where they're burning up parts of what they'd cut off of the people. Terrible thought. Oh, you can't believe how bad it smelled. But we're burning that off at the back. We hung around to the beach then for an extra day to pick up casualties, where all the other LSTs picked up and went back to England to get another load. So we were a day after them. So we went back over to England, unloaded our casualties, and picked up another load and went right back over to Normandy. And we did that for about five times until a big storm came in. We lost our anchor and managed to hit something with the screw and knocked a blade off the screw. And so we had to go back and bend a shaft and had to go back into dry dock to get it fixed. So when they fixed it, we didn't get back on the shuttle. They sent us down to the Mediterranean for the August landings down there where we landed in St. Tropez. That was a very quiet, easy operation. Went over there, we were in the morning at daylight, we crack of dawn, we and a few other LSTs were sitting out there off Cavalier Bay, waiting for the orders to go in and unload our people. We had the 3rd Division soldiers aboard, real good soldiers. These guys have been fighting in Italy for a year, and they were really good soldiers. So we waiting out there, and eventually we got the order about noon to go on the beach and unload our troops. And so we went to the Gulf St. Tropez and beached and unloaded our people. Got stuck on the beach, couldn't get off until an army bulldozer came down and helped push us off. Went back over and went back, Italy, and brought another load of soldiers over. And then we went, came back and landed in Marseille, right down there, the middle of town, and picked up a, unloaded our people and picked up a load of prisoners and took them back to North Africa. And then we picked up Algerian troops and carried them back over to southern France. Ran that shuttle about four or five times. We had the one time, it was very scary. We picked up a load of British tanks. We had about 25 tanks on board. And they're all chained down, of course. What they do in LST, when you want to chain something down, they just weld a bracket on the deck and hook a chain to it. Well, anyway, the ship got rolling, broke all those tanks loose. So it'd roll over one way, and all the tanks would slide down and bang into the bulkhead. And then it would slowly roll up the other way, and the other way, and the tanks would all slide the other direction, slide down, bang into the bulkhead. We couldn't do that very long before they pound a hole, the ship, you know, break your ship up. And so the captain went down to see what he could do, and the next thing you know, I went down to see what was going on. And there's the captain out there hanging on to a gun barrel or one of the tanks, swinging like a pendulum. He was going to throw timbers. Instead of sending somebody else down, he wouldn't ask them to do something he wouldn't do. Him and the bosun mate went on there, and they threw enough timbers in between the tanks to stop them sliding, but he changed course of the ship so he didn't roll. It was rolling 35 degrees, and that's the limit LST would roll. If it rolled more than 35, it would keep right on going. And I was scared, got scared at that time. We thought it was, if we rolled over, that'd be the end of everybody. Well, it didn't. We finally got down to Marseille, and I brought back one souvenir, as I remember. I didn't have room to carry souvenirs, but I bought a little vase. I'll tell you, the French are entrepreneurs. Maybe they'd made them in advance, but they had all these, went to a little shop, and it was loaded with all these little, all these ceramics, all designed to sell to American soldiers. And so I bought this little vase about 8 inches maybe by 3 inches wide because it was flat and I could put it in my sea bag and bring it home. And I did, I brought it home. We lost that during the fire. That was a shame, a little vase. Of all the souvenirs I had, that was the best one I had brought home. Yeah, I gave it to my mother. After about, we did about maybe 5 shuttle runs between North Africa, Algeria, and Marseille, when they decided that was enough of that, and so we came back to the United States. And we outfitted the ship, added a radar to it. We didn't have a radar. Didn't add a radar and evaporator so we could make fresh water. Painted the tropical colors and sailed off for the Pacific, and that was all. See, this was in August. This was in, I spent December and Christmas in New York City. They gave everybody another 30-day leave, but my folks had just moved to Arizona. And there was no place to go, so I stayed in New York for a month. By that time, I was promoted to chief quartermaster, and so I spent my time dating girls and going to shows. One thing, in uniform, you went to the ticket place. There was a ticket booth in Times Square, and you could get tickets to anywhere, anything that they had a surplus of tickets for. And so I got to see a lot of shows. A lot of shows, even went to the opera a couple times. Saw Frank Sinatra. He was at the Paramount Theater and went to Paramount Theater to see Sinatra. A nice month. It was middle, except it was the middle of winter, colder than cold in New York. But otherwise, it was a very pleasant month spent in New York. Then we bundled up the ship. Once we got after that, we loaded up the ship and we headed for the Pacific. We had a load aboard of all kinds of stuff. And on the way down to Guantanamo Bay, we got hit by a freighter. Guy lost his steering, came over and hit it, rammed us in the side. Fortunately, didn't do any real serious damage. Stopped in Guantanamo Bay for overnight or two. I never got ashore. Then we went on down to Panama. And by the time we got to Panama, one of the engines was bad and they had to repair the engine. We missed the convoy to the Pacific. It was heading for Guam. Missed the convoy, so we sailed across by ourselves, all alone, out in the middle of that big ocean. Took 28 days to go from Panama to Honolulu. But we found Honolulu. By that time, I was doing all the navigating on the ship. And most of the crew said, we'll never find Hawaii, out in the middle of that ocean. But I knew where we were. And so we did find Hawaii. And so, like usual, my usual luck, the captain says, okay, half the crew can go ashore today, and other, you know, that's port and starboard liberty, he said. So I said to the other quartermaster, I said, well, you go in today, I'll go in tomorrow. Well, tomorrow never came. Next morning, off we go. Same damn thing happened over in Italy. We had a great guy for a captain. We were anchored off of Pompeii. And the captain says, okay, guys, he said, everybody should see Pompeii. He said, so half the crew can go in today and the other half can go in tomorrow. So the same thing, I said, told the guy, the other quartermaster that was on board the ship, Majors Blackie, that was what he called him, Blackie. I said, you go in Blackie and I'll go in tomorrow. Same damn thing, tomorrow never came. So I didn't get to Pompeii either. Yeah, so we landed in Eniwetok Atoll, which is about 3 feet above sea level. And they'd fought a battle through Eniwetok, and the whole ground was people buried everywhere, and it was a real mess. They sent a beer party ashore. Well, I didn't drink beer. Nasty, nasty thing. I tell you, people can be very cruel. There was a pipe sticking up out of the ground with a funnel wand on the end of it. And it says, pee here into the mouth of a dead Jap. Can you imagine that? Imagine that? Well, anyway, that's what you run into during the war. I mean, that was very cruel, very cruel.
The stories aren't always easy to hear, but they always give us a better understanding of what things were really like. It's time for our first break, but we'll hear more of his memories from the Pacific when we come back. 105-year-old Martin Copenhafer of Garden Valley, California, our guest again. You can find photos and a short video with him at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 105-year-old Martin Copenhafer, truly a survivor. He survived the sinking of his LST in Sicily in 1943, made it through D-Day less than a year later. More recently, he lost his home in Malibu, California, to the Palisades Fire. But even at 105, those memories have not faded, and that includes the work his LST carried out in the Pacific, too, after they had landed troops and vehicles in Normandy and then southern France.
Eniwetok was terrible. We stayed there just a couple of days and then on to Guam. Guam was very pleasant. Beautiful weather. We got there in April, I guess, we got there. Just with the usual luck we had a pilot to position the ship and take it into where you're going to tie it up. Darned if you didn't run over a buoy and knock a blade off the screw. So here we are sitting there. You can't proceed with us. We had two screws. We had spares, but you can't run the ship with a screw with a blade off it. So we were waiting for a Navy diver to come to change the screw. Well, couldn't get a Navy diver. So after about 3 weeks, the bosun mate, he says, well, I'll change the screw, he said. Can't wait here forever. So without any diving suit, he did it all by just taking a breath of air, going down, doing some work, coming back up, going down, and took off the screw and put on the other screw, the bosun mate. He was a hell of a guy, really. He eventually wound up a four-stripe captain. Wow. That's in the regular Navy. Yeah, eventually he stayed in. He was a real Mustang, but a very capable guy. He and I stayed friends all along. Yeah, Clark was his name, Thomas Breckinridge Clark. Yeah, he was from New York. Yeah, real, real good man. Yeah, we met him down in Florida after, met him at all our Navy reunions, and last time we saw him down in Florida when we did a trip to Florida. Real good guy. So we loaded up, and we were already loaded up. We had a combat load aboard. So we headed up for Okinawa, and by that time, the kamikazes were all done. The invasion was pretty well settled. The kamikazes weren't coming in anymore. So, interesting thing, I tell everybody. We pulled into Naha, Okinawa, which at that time was the capital of it. Couldn't see anything. I don't know whether any buildings there or not. All we saw was beach. We pulled alongside a ship that was already there. It was a big wooden ship, I'd say maybe 100 feet long, maybe a little bigger. And it was a floating brothel, is what it was, a brothel. And we'd watch the scene. We were right next to it, and I watched the girls come out, and they had a door on the side of the ship. And they'd come out and wash out and then go on back and board the ship, wait for the next big, long line of GIs waiting to go into this brothel. Be great if you had taken a photo of it, but we didn't have a camera. But I figured, I was thinking, I said, a month ago, those were Japanese soldiers in that line. This time, they're American soldiers in the line. Yeah, that was so interesting. That was, we spent a little time there, more time than I like. Okinawa is a terrible place. But we were a big Navy base south end of Buckner Bay. We sailed back and forth between Naha and Buckner Bay a couple times. I don't know why, but we seemed like the Navy couldn't decide where we should be. But anyway, the last time we sailed over to Buckner Bay, we organized a little convoy, about 10, 12 ships, and LSTs. And so turns out we had a commander aboard. Nice guy, really, but a pain in the butt. Commander Wilson. And so he checks the ranking of the other, data rank of the other guy that was going to be the convoy commander, and discovers he is senior. So he calls the guy and says, I'm in command now. He says, I'm senior officer present. So he says, I will lead the convoy over. So it's getting dark by this time. So like always, it's always dark with no moon. So off we go leading this string of LSTs towards Buckner Bay. It wasn't very far. It was only about a four-hour trip maybe. And so we get going along, and we have a radar by now. And we have a radar operator who's keeping track of where the coastline is. And it doesn't take bearings on. It's pitch black. And so we go along and go along until, by dead reckoning, the commander tells the captain, well, it's time to turn in. I think we're off the entrance. The entrance wasn't very wide to the bay. It was only maybe a couple hundred yards wide. So we go up and we turn in until the bow guy up hollers, breakers ahead, he said. So the captain stops the engines and we back down and come back and continue to run down the reef for another another 10 minutes till we finally find the entrance to the bay. And the ships behind us. Now, if you ever see a column of ships go, everyone turns a little sooner. So the next morning we look out there and there's three LSTs sitting on the reef. The last three in line all turned in too soon. Well, this really shook up the commander. On his record, he was convoy commodore, and he's responsible for those ships sitting on there. And he's all shook up. And so he wants to blame everybody. He wanted to blame the radar operator. He wanted to blame the captain of the ship. And couldn't blame him because he was responsible. So he goes over to the port commander over there, some captain in charge of Buckner Bay there. And he says to the captain over there, he says, I want a court-martial. I want to clear my record. And the captain says, forget about it, he said. He says, we had a hurricane here a couple weeks ago, and we got 60 ships on the beach over here. He says, three more of us don't make a gosh darn bit of difference. But he insisted on having a court-martial. So the captain and the radar operator and him all got on an airplane, and they flew off somewhere to have a little court-martial to clear his record. He was not a bad guy, really, except in the Navy you learn a few things. One of them is that senior officers, like commanders and captains, don't talk to enlisted men. They talk to junior officers who talk to enlisted men. But he wasn't that bad a guy, really. I used to talk to him all the time, and I always get back from him pretty much as a grunt, you know, to acknowledge I'd said something to him, because he was always on the bridge where he had no business, and me, that was my territory. And so so I know we were up to Japan later on. We went up to Japan to carry up occupation troops. We took them up there in September. We were up there a couple weeks after they signed the peace treaty. We were up there in Japan and carrying guys up to drop off occupation troops. So we went and sailed up there around the north end of Honshu, and it was nice weather and everything. So someone says, why don't we go fishing? So they went to the captain of the ship and says, can we borrow a boat? You know, we carried six boats and go fishing. The captain says, sure, he's a good guy. You want to go fishing? Okay. So the commander loaned us his fishing equipment. So me and about five other guys got in the boat and we went fishing. Up there, the water was nice and it was pretty, and we trolled around with that big LSAV, that 40-foot boat trying to fish. Did catch a tuna, actually did catch a fish, and got stuck on a reef, and we all had to peel off and jump overboard and push the boat off a reef. We thought, here we are in the middle of nowhere, stuck on a reef. That was no fun. Got worried about that, but we managed to get it off, get back to the ship. They cooked our fish for us. Yeah, we dropped off troops at Shigama, which is the port city for Sendai. Went into Sendai, hitchhiked into Sendai, I remember. Walked in town, and here right on the edge of town is a pile of rifles, about as tall as this room is, and about as wide. Wow. There's thousands of rifles, all in a big pile there. So I walked over to the guy, there was a soldier over there guarding the pile, and I said, hey, can I have a rifle? He said, help yourself, take as many as you want. So I went over and looked at it and sorted through them to find one that wasn't rusty and picked one of them up and brought it home, brought it back to the States. Yeah. That's how things were, pretty loose and easy, you know, things really. Really, when you talk to GIs, why there was no fuss, no muss, particularly in the amphibious forces. It was pretty good, the amphibious forces. It wasn't like being on a fleet ship. You're on a cruiser or a battleship. Terrible, terrible. I mean, it was all spit and polish and all that stuff, and where they had senior officers' country, like you know, where even the junior officers weren't allowed in parts of the ship, the upper level decks up there. For example, when the battleship New Jersey visited San Pedro back about 5, maybe 10 years ago, why the Navy League Malibu we had the guy that was good. My neighbor was a captain in the Navy Reserve. And so he arranged to have the Navy League go down and tour the ship to New Jersey. So we went down there. They broke our party up. We probably had 30, 40 people, the Navy League people, and broke them up. And each one of the parties got an officer, generally a junior officer, an ensign or Lieutenant JG, to escort us around the ship. And they gave us a hell of a good tour. We got to climb into a gun turret, have a gunner's mate in there explain to us how the whole thing worked in the gun turret. And we got to walk in the engine room and see the engine room. And then we went up in the senior officer's country, up where the captain had his boardroom up there. So anyway, this guy's with us, this is JG, Lieutenant JG, and we go up there and he says, you know, fellas, he says, this is the second time I've been allowed up here, he said, to take this tour party around. He said, the only other time was for my performance evaluation. Otherwise, he says, I'm restricted. I can't come up here. Uh-huh. Yeah. So we got to see the Admiral's quarter. Our Admiral had a room up there, and the captain had a room, of course. And, yeah, it was interesting. Yeah. And got to walk into the wheelhouse to see where all that stuff was. They have in the captain's room, there's two big chairs raised up high where you can look out to see what's going on. Nobody sits in those chairs but the captain. That's his chair. Nobody touches it. You don't get in there. The Navy rank is everything, much worse than the Army, but rank is everything. Like I mentioned, the senior officers like that don't talk to enlisted men. They talk to junior officers who talk to enlisted men. Except we had Commander Wilson had little choice sometimes, you know. He was always bumbling around down there in the wheelhouse in the chart room where he had no business being anyway. But he was a good guy. I mean, really basically a good guy. I know somebody, we had a bunch of radios in that chart room. Over there, we had a very big chart table about the size of this one here. And above it was a shelf with a bunch of radios on it. Well, somebody hadn't bolted down a radio up there. And he was in there, and the ship got rolling, and one of those radios came flying off and hit him right on the elbow. And he got a big swollen elbow, really bad. Now, some people would have thrown a fit about that. You know, who's responsible for this? Well, he never said a word. He was pretty good. He just took it as this is what things happen, you know, accidents happen. He was pretty good that way. But we had a radio staff. That was part of my bunch, was the radio men. We had two radio men. That was part of my bunch. I had about 20 people that were up there from the bridge gang. We did all the flag hoists. When we were in Tokyo Bay, I took the pennant down. Every Navy ship carries a pennant. Mm-hmm. It's about maybe 2.5 feet long, and carries it right on the highest part of the ship, on the highest mast on the ship. You have this pennant that you fly, this pennant. As soon as we got clear of Tokyo Bay, I shinned up the mast and traded the pennant. So I had the pennant to throw over Tokyo Bay and had it home. That was one of my souvenirs that I had in the living room of the house. When it got burned, yeah, it was pretty good. I had the date written. I wrote the date on it, what the date was. We were there in Tokyo Bay. We were there very early. I never got ashore there in Tokyo or Yokohama. We did have one Liberty party get to shore. Once again, I told the other quartermaster, yeah, you go ahead. I'll come in tomorrow. And he went to Yokohama. Nothing to see anyway. The place all shot up. Wasn't worth visiting.
It's time for our final break, but we'll get some final thoughts from Mr. Copenhafer when we come back, including a glimpse into his work for the assessor's office in Los Angeles County. Which celebrity homes made an impression on him? Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, wrapping up our second episode with an amazing 105-year-old survivor of D-Day and so much more. Martin Copenhafer of Garden Valley, California, has shared about the sinking of his LST in July of 1943, about the Operation Tiger disaster 9 months later, and then what he experienced off of Omaha Beach on June 6, 1944. We've heard a little bit of his memories from the Pacific, too, but what about the men with whom he served?
I had worked with good people. And this one fellow, my first guy was John Bond, a fellow that on the first LST. And the second LST was a fellow named Majoris. He was from New Jersey. He always wanted me to come over and visit with his wife and family for dinner when we were back in New York, but I never did. I should have. He was a real good guy and a very capable guy, too. And so I was very fortunate with these guys. They were very. The one guy, John Bond, he wound up very well to do, very well to do. He wound up with a great big machine shop. And I know he and our executive officer of the ship used to talk when we'd have a reunion. They'd be talking about the stock market, about what you got your money in now, John, you know, that kind of stuff. This guy that was the executive officer, he became the head of the VA for state of Mississippi. I remember one time when I was talking to him, he says, "You come back to Mississippi." He says, "We'll take care of you." He said, Yeah, we had a reunion back there 1 year in Mississippi, Jackson, terrible place, Jackson. But anyway, we had this reunion back there, and he organized everything. One day he took, had a bus come and pick up the people, and he took us out to a cotton field. He says, "Everybody get out of the bus now and go out and pick some cotton." I tell you, picking cotton's not easy.
Nope.
It's very hard, hard work. You have to crunch up your fingers to reach in there to pull the bowl out. I mean, I don't know how you can do much of that, but anyway, that's how you pick cotton. So we went down from there. We went on down to a cotton gin where they ginned it and baled it. Mm-hmm. I went down there noisier than anything you can imagine. Noisy, dusty, dirty. But that's what did the cotton. Then he took us out to his cattle ranch. He raised cattle. He raised 300 cattle a year. He had three different fields where he said he had 100 cows, had 100 calves of his own, needed to buy a couple hundred more, and raised these cattle. And when they got to be a year old, he'd send them to the market. Then we went out to his woodlot. He had a forest as well as everything else. And he showed us their logging operation where they had this piece of equipment to drive up to a tree, would saw it off and pick it up and toss it into a stack. So we saw then we were going to have a big barbecue that night at his house. He lived in just a regular ranch house, and so it rained. So it looked bad. He said, "Not to worry," he said. So he was a churchgoer, this guy, very much in. So he called up the church and says, "I'm stuck out here with my whole party of people. We got to serve dinner tonight." And they says, "Bring them down to here. We'll take care of it." And by golly, they did. They cooked us up a great steak dinner. He provided the steaks down here. People from this local community church showed up and put on the dinner for us. I mean, he was a pretty well-known guy in the area, of course. He owned a big ranch there. He said a farm. He called it a farm, but he must have had several thousand acres anyway to have all the stuff there that he had. Yeah. but a real good man. I remember, good friend. Yeah, he was the executive officer on the ship. Yeah, he was responsible to do the navigating, but he didn't do any of it. I did it. Yeah, we were on, because that's one reason I think we were on for such good terms.
I've got just a few more questions for you. I'm wondering, are you one of those who feels like the atomic bomb saved your life?
Yeah. Well, probably, yes, very likely. We were along with hundreds of other LSTs all gathering together to do the invasion of Japan. This was in August, and the invasion was set for November 1st. And we knew we were going to have to go in. And after all the kamikaze attacks they had in Okinawa, we figured it would be even worse there at Japan. And the LSTs are large stationary target. That's what they were. We figured there'd be a hell of a lot of losses. We were not looking forward to it. Yeah, we figured it would be a... So we were... Everybody was happy as could be after the bomb was dropped and Japan surrendered. Mm-hmm. Yes, we were very happy about that.
And, you know, you told me about your experience on D-Day. What beach were you at?
Omaha Red. Uh-huh. We were right at where all the action was, yeah, at Omaha Red. And we were far enough off beach shore where the Germans didn't have any guns to shell all those ships sitting out there off the beach. The guns they had were in those concrete, they're all built in concrete, but they covered the beach rather than covered the sea. And they had a bunch of guns there, six-inch guns. Could have done a lot of damage, but they didn't. They were aimed at the beach. And so we were a mile off the beach, and later, after we launched those tanks that sank, we moved out to about 4 miles, where we're pretty much out of range of anything. Yeah, we really couldn't see the action from where we were and what was going on the beach. What we had was the small boats that were coming back and forth all the time, bringing people out, bringing out the wounded people, taking more of the people in, and they'd tell us what was going on the beach. They'd pull in there and unload people and pick up casualties and see what the debris and everything, and come back and tell us what was going on. Yeah, that's kind of how we knew. What people don't know, of course, is that 11 o'clock on D-Day, we got a word from the General Bradley, who was in charge of the operation, prepared to evacuate the people on the beach. Thought they're going to stop the invasion right there because they're taking so many casualties. And so we thought, oh boy, that's going to be fun, getting those people off the beach back on board the ship and abandon all the equipment. They changed their mind in about 10 or 15 minutes. But there wasn't, they came that close to backing off. Well, the British were doing okay on their beach, and we did already at Utah Beach. And so apparently when they weighed the things, they decided, well, go ahead, we'll continue with the assault on Omaha because they were taking so many casualties on Omaha. I don't know if you ever have been there, but right above Omaha Beach is a big cemetery. There's about 9,000 people buried there, and there's a big memorial there. I've been there a couple times, and I'll tell you, it's heartbreaking. Yeah, see all that stuff there. I was there for the first time when they had on Memorial Day, and they had a big memorial service going, and was there. Could have gone over there at the 80th anniversary, while the Navy League offered to pay my way over there if I wanted to go back over there for it. But no, I didn't want to go back. I was in no shape to go back over there in 2 years ago. No shape to make the trip. Love to have done it if I could have otherwise, but I just wasn't up to the trip. We had one guy on board of the ship that younger than me, five, six years younger than me, that went over and took one of those tours about 25 years ago. Those battlefield tours when he came over. He went over there to Normandy, and then he stayed with the army group that he was with all the way up to the end of the war. Like my older brother, he was over there D-Day plus 10, and he was on the fight all the way up to the end of it. He got out before I did. He got out of the army two or three months before I got out of the Navy. Most of us couldn't get out quick enough. I shouldn't have gotten off. I should have stayed on the ship. I got off the ship at Okinawa, terrible place, and couldn't find a ride back to the United States. For 2 weeks I lived over at Okinawa looking for a ride back to the States. Our ship got orders to return to the United States about the same time I got off of it. If I'd stayed aboard it, I'd have been back almost the same time. So I'd been better off on board the ship coming back. That was a mistake, another mistake I made. Should have stayed with it, because the guys that came back on board, it was much, much, they sailed it into San Francisco, and it went up, was scrapped up there in Antioch or somewhere like that. That's where they scrapped the ship out. Yeah, they scrapped out all those LSTs. They were built pretty flimsy, half-inch steel plate, just welded together, by women welders. Women did all the welding back in Pittsburgh. And then they came through with a, smoothed off the surface with the chipper, chipped the surface on it. And the women did a good job. LSTs were flexible. They didn't have a keel. They were flat bottom, no keel. But surprisingly, they held together. They rode out some pretty rough weather. I think it was Churchill's idea. He decided that's what they needed. And the thing was his idea. They were based on a tanker, Lake Maracaibo tanker. They called it a shallow water tanker that they used in Venezuela. And they had lots of tanks. And down below the tank deck, it was all tanks. We carried lots of water, lots of fuel. They had enough fuel to go around the world a couple times. And we were always giving fuel to people. And I remember one time when we were over in England, the battleship Texas was over there. And they'd been over there by Cherbourg, shelling Cherbourg, and the Cherbourg was shelling back, and they hit it two or three times. And they were running the Texas at flank speed to keep from getting sunk. And so they came into one of those little town down there where we happened to be, and they didn't have any water left. They'd used up all the water, their water in this little fracas they were in. So we pulled up alongside them with our LST, and these guys in the battleship looks down at this crew we have, the way the guys are dressed, you know, just wearing dungarees and wearing big long beards and didn't look at all like in U.S. Navy. They looked down there, and they couldn't believe it was the crew down there. So the guy that was the head quartermaster on board the Texas, I know him. I've been in quartermaster class with him. He says, "I'll come on over and have lunch with us," he said. So I went on board the Texas for lunch. And, man, I'll tell you, what a different experience from what you have in the Navy on an LST. We all went in the room, a big room down there. All the people slept in hammocks. At night, after morning, you got up and wound up your hammock and stacked it up, hung it up against the bulkhead. We'd set up a big, long table, and the whole quartermaster staff is all sitting at this table, all at attention. And the head quartermaster of the group, that was the guy that I knew, a fellow named Burns, he sits in there, and he sits down at the table, and we're served a lunch on china. Yeah, we have mess attendants coming in, bring us our food, setting it down in front of us. Nobody touches anything until the head guy up there says, "Okay, time, we'd have lunch." When he starts eating lunch, other people can. That's how it was on a battleship. Yeah, thank goodness it wasn't that way on an LST. It was very loose, and even on our captain, the last one, the second one in particular, Adams, he says, "You guys do your job," he says, "and we'll all get along just fine." And that's the way it was. He didn't care. We were in the Mediterranean. Everybody cut off their blue jeans into shorts, grew big long beards, didn't wear a shirt, didn't look anything like a Navy. But that's how it was. And just as long as they did their job, that's all he wanted. And everybody loved him. Yeah.
You mentioned the American Cemetery at Normandy. Yes. I'm wondering, have you been to the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C.?
You mean down in the mall? There where they have, I've been there. I've been to the mall several times. I keep adding different things to it all the time. Oh, sure, went to the World War II Memorial. The last time we were there, we visited that. We had our Navy reunion in Washington, one of our last reunions, and we have a bus take us for a ride, and we went up there and toured that, and went to Franklin Roosevelt's memorial. I wonder if people know he has one there too. And went to the Korean War Memorial. And I'll tell you, the Vietnam Memorial, that's a tough one, I'll tell you. The Vietnam, that's the most effective memorial I've ever seen. Yeah, that one. Yeah, I'm pretty hard-boiled, but I'll tell you, that one, that's a tough one.
Because of the names?
But, yeah, all those names, that wall of names. Mm-hmm. All those 55,000 people that got killed. Yeah, that's a tough one, I'll tell you, that Vietnam Memorial. Washington is a place everybody should visit, given the opportunity. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You should visit the war memorials. We should visit the museums. There's no place that has museums like Washington has. They've got the Mellon Art Museum, and then they got all those other ones, the Smithsonian Museums. Yeah. Person should visit them. Go in and see the Hope Diamond. I've been there a couple of times. Yeah, things like that.
Thank you for being so generous with your time. I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country.
Well, and you get me talking, you can't shut me up. That's one of the problems.
Well, I bet you've got some Hollywood stories, too. Was there one movie star or celebrity whose house you appraised that made a good impression on you?
Well, Robert Taylor. I remember Robert Taylor's house, for one. We went to see his house, and Robert Taylor had a brand spanking new house over there up in Pacific Palisades. And what was the most impressive about the house was his closet. He had a closet. Good God, it was big. And it had, just like a clothing store, he had all these sports coats hanging there. He must have had 100 sports coats hanging in that closet. But once again, it was like most of those when we met a celebrity. Why, they'd say, just go about, do your business, you know what you got to do. I never had a celebrity argue about his assessment, never once. Might want to talk about it, but they never argued about it, never. The people that argued about assessments, by and large, were guys that owned apartment houses, people that built apartment houses. What they would do is they'd set up a big apartment project at the same time they built their house. Then they'd charge all the labor on their house off against the apartment. And so they never have that much money in their house. They'd have half their labor was charged against some other job. So right away they want a low assessment. So of course that doesn't go with the assessor. He assesses it like whether you pay for it like everybody else pays for it. Whether you save a half $1 million on labor, doesn't count. The firemen the same way, by the way. They all trade labor and they help each other build their houses. And when they can become some of your biggest problems because they all want a low assessment because they don't have all the costs in the property that other people have. Well, that's something you can't consider. You're more concerned with the market value. What'll it bring on the market, not what you paid for it or what it cost you to build? And so firemen and apartment house builders, that was part of the job, talking with people. I mean, but the celebrities had very little problem with them. We had some, but we did see some awfully interesting buildings and talk to some awfully interesting people, in this course of the business there. Yeah, I remember this one woman, she was big on TV at the time. And we came into her house, she had done something, had a building permit for something. And she was just as cute and as nice as she could be. She runs over and starts to roll off the rug. Rug says, "Oh, she's taking my rug," she said. She was just kidding, of course. But we ran into people like that that were just as nice as can be. Yeah. I remember that gal that had her legs insured for $1 million. I went to her house one time. We were chatting, and she's in there checking her calendar because she operated by a Jewish calendar. Her husband's Jewish. Mm-hmm. And so everything had to be kosher, she said. Yeah, I was surprised to hear that. And we had Zaza Gabor. Zaza, we had a lot of doings with Zaza. I mean, she was a troublemaker. And I remember she's the one that once said that she collected houses. She married guys and wound up owning their house. And Zaza, she came into the office one day and had to go out and talk to her. That was when we had an office in Santa Monica. And I talked to Zaza. And so we have to make an appointment to go out to see her house. She had a house that she was living in. She chipping away at the assessment. That was quite typical. People chip away at the assessment. I don't blame them, of course. But I remember we sent an appraiser out, a senior appraiser out to see Zaza. And it was middle of the day, and she still wasn't dressed. And so he stood at the foot of the steps, and she stood at the top of the steps, hollering back and forth to each other, trying to carry on the conversation. He said she wasn't made up yet or anything, and she wasn't going to come down if she was dressed properly and done properly. It probably took her an hour to do her face. And but anyway, yeah, with people like that. I talked to her for once, but I didn't have much to say when she came into the office. All I could tell her was, "You want us to review it, I'll send an appraiser out." And so I did send this guy out there. Yeah, he was kind of a hard-boiled character. But we met a lot of people that way at different times. You know, like one of the most important is the guy, of course, that screwed the detonator into the bomb that they dropped at Hiroshima.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we went out to see him. He called up and wanted someone to review his assessment. So a senior appraiser and I went out to see him, and nicest guy he ever met. And we sat down, and he's telling us about the flight up to Hiroshima and the Noage. He said when they got up there, he got time while he got the detonator out, and he screwed it into the bomb, he said, before they dropped it. You know, he was the guy that did things himself. He was working on his swimming pool. He had a leak of some kind. And he got a shovel and dug it all out himself, and he was going to fix the plumbing himself. And here's a guy, you know, who's living in a big, expensive mansion, and he's out there working on it himself. I know after we chatted with him, we went in his coffee breakfast room and sat down and had a cup of coffee with him. And he's telling us about things, about his experiences about the fight over to Hiroshima.
Well, I don't know how easy it is because you've been through a lot in 105 years.
Yeah.
But when you think back over all of that, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Oh, I don't know. I'm most proud of my Navy service mainly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the only thing probably ever did that was really worthwhile was serving the Navy. Yeah, for the years and got through all that okay. I was lucky on that. You know, I was lucky to survive a ship bombing and sinking. I was lucky to do that. But otherwise, I lived a very quiet life. I would, if I had it to do over again, I wouldn't live it the same way. I would do just like everybody else did after they got out of the service that was my age, go find a wife somewhere or another and get married and raise a family, which I did not do, but I was kind of looking after my parents. That took priority, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I bought them a house to live in, and then my father passed away while I bought another house, more or less for my mother to live in out in Malibu, and that sort of thing. Yeah, I've been better off. I had a wife and kids. I had opportunities I should have taken advantage of, which I would, doing it again, I would take advantage of one of the opportunities and find a wife. Yeah, I knew a couple of nice gals that probably would have done very well, made good wives. I don't have much opportunity to do anything anymore. I can, my eyesight isn't the greatest, and I can't hear without this hearing aid. No, nothing I can do. I'm stuck. I'm more or less hobbled by all the health problems. I'm too old, can't do anything. I should have. I had written up my genealogy. I wrote up all my genealogy, had that all organized. That's all gone, all got burned up. I spent a lot of time on that, 20 years doing that. And that was a shame. I wrote that, could rewrite that family history. Most families don't get into family history. They're not interested, really. Many people have zero interest in their grandparents or their great-grandparents or where your family came from or what they did. Well, most of them don't care.
The audience for this show might be an exception to that rule, but if you didn't care before, you probably care now after listening to 105-year-old Martin Copenhafer's World War II memories on these last two episodes of Hometown Heroes. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.